Hello, Epicurean universe.
I gotcha. She's at it again.
Well, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to have one sweet program today.
Sure, and we hope you're all Epicureans, and you're all probably enophiles as well. But, but today, as Ann was saying, it's all about sweet things, because people love sweet things. And even if Anne is a solitary exception and really doesn't all that much. But she was absolutely in love with our first guest.
Oh, I certainly...
Even though everything... No, actually, not everything he does is about sweets, as you'll find out when you listen to the interview, because it turns out that according to extraordinary chocolatier Paul Young, who called us all the way from London to talk about his new book and his career...
All kinds of
exciting things to do with this wonderful substance called chocolate, which we've covered before on the program, but I think Paul is perhaps the most fascinating interview we've ever done.
Yeah, he's smart, and he's stylish. I mean, it really is a stylish
and
book,
he's a self-made young man. It's really quite amazing
he
what
knows
he's
quite a lot about chocolate.
But what he's achieved in his career is really quite remarkable, and I'm sure you'll find it a fascinating conversation.
It's always a wonderful surprise when I meet someone, even if I'm meeting them telephonically, that comes from the same part of the world as I do and has gone on to make something of a success of his life in spite of his humble beginnings. And our current guest, Paul Young, who's calling us from England, I think, who's still working there and has built a wonderful career for himself making chocolate, has decided to share many, if not all, of his secrets with us. Paul, welcome to On the Menu, first of all.
Hello, how are you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, Paul, and you know, the book is called Adventures with Chocolate, and it certainly gets to be, by the time you get to the end of this book, it's just wonderful, but I like the subtitle even better. It's called 80 Sensational Recipes, and it's that too.
Oh, you should see the pictures. Sometimes I want to do video, because it would be so wonderful to show these pictures.
You know, I did a tweet after I looked through your book, saying that the photographs were so fabulous in this book that as I was reading it and turning the pages, I had an intense feeling that I was smelling chocolate.
If only the pages could move.
There you go. Now, how did you come to this place? It's not a conventional thing to be an artisan chocolatier.
It's not. It was all accidental. I trained as a chef and worked around Yorkshire and Durham as a normal chef. And just out of doing one job for a catering agency, I ended up working with some of Marc Pierre White's chefs for a very big event and was lucky enough to be asked to stay with them on this event for quite a few months. It was a tour of the UK, and I got asked if I'd like to join permanently at Marc Pierre White's Criterion Brasserie in London, in Piccadilly. That was in 96.
So he must have thought you were pretty good, huh?
They thought it was pretty good, thank goodness. So I packed up over a weekend, started working there, and stayed with Marc Pierre White for 6 years, working my way up to head pâtissier, Quo Vadis in Soho. And as a pâtissier, I used chocolate every day. Not necessarily to make chocolates, but to make, you know, chocolate tarts, souffles, desserts. And 2 years after leaving, and I was doing other things and... Between then, developing new products for retailers and teaching people how to bake and all kinds of things, really, chocolate started to take over. It just seemed to naturally be involved in my life, and it's a strange thing to say when you don't consciously do it, but every demonstration, every kitchen class, every cookery class I did, somehow every class ended up having chocolate involved. And people in the industry started to ask me to develop chocolates for them to improve their current collections. Some really long longevity brands in the UK, like Charbonnelle Walker. I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. It was one of those things that really happened. And here we are, years later, with my own brand, three shops, and people really wanting to try new chocolates and to have them made in the artisan way.
Now, that's happening in the United States as well, to a significant extent, and you know some of the people involved in doing that. We're not sure the extent to which this had happened in the UK, so are you still the exception rather than the rule?
Even in London, I'm in London now. Like I said, I came down here in 96 and didn't go back to Yorkshire to live, but there's still not many of us who have specialised, especially when we're so close to Belgium, France, Holland, Switzerland, where every other street corner has a patisserie or a chocolate shop. Even in London, you can count on one hand who are the real artisan chocolatiers and who are the bigger mass production companies. Well, I don't know why that is, because there's such a revolution of food here in the UK, especially in London.
Oh, yes, there certainly is.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, we come and look at it every year, and every year it gets more interesting and more interesting and more interesting, and the more new places opening. It is curious, but I guess in a way it's fortunate for you that the competition isn't there, so you can have three shops. If there's more competition, maybe you'd only have one.
Absolutely, and I think it's in a way, and this isn't meant to sound arrogant, it's meant to sound proud, because I've worked hard with my team to build up that reputation and to keep the chocolates and what we do the same from day one to now, which is 5.5 years later from opening our first shop, keeping that the same, looking after the customers, using the best ingredients, and not selling out, not mass producing, not replacing people by machines. And I think maybe that sometimes is intimidating for people coming into the industry, but I always try to encourage people to come into the industry and try to inspire them, which is why I wrote the book. That book isn't just for chefs, it's for people who want to have a go, who think, I want to try, I don't know where to start, I don't know even which chocolate to buy, but once they've read the book and looked through the book, they can have that little more confidence to get into the industry.
Now, you have some very good recommendations about how to go about obtaining your ingredients. The first is really so simple and obvious, you might say, why would you even say that? But you say, buy absolutely the best ingredients.
I do say that, and I say that because if you start with poor quality chocolate, or say, poor quality ingredients, so you bought an ingredient from a supermarket, for instance, which has been cultivated, so you're using herbs, and I use a lot of herbs, in spices, but say you've bought something that is really not great quality to start with, there's no way of making that taste good. If
right.
It doesn't taste good at the beginning, it won't taste good at the end.
And you, by the way, you make point teaching people how to taste chocolate.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, was a revelation. All kinds of little things like that chocolate's the only food that melts at body temperature.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Funny, because when we eat, and we all do it, we just eat and we enjoy what we eat. And if you're eating, for example, a pizza, in your head you know exactly what that pizza will taste like even before eating it, because you're so familiar with it, even if the topping is different. But with chocolate, there's so many unbelievably different varieties and tastes and textures in chocolate that you could taste a dark chocolate and really not like it at all and say, I don't like dark chocolate. But then try another one from a different country or a different percentage or a different producer has made it, and you can absolutely love it. So the key is to try lots of chocolate, and I think there's nothing bad in that, is there? I mean, there's nothing better than eating lots of chocolate.
Yeah, the only thing I can remember growing up that horrified me is that I didn't like milk chocolate, and everybody in the rest of England liked milk chocolate. All the chocolates around my family at Christmas time or birthdays were all milk chocolate, and I thought it tasted awful.
That's really odd, because obviously we're from the same area in the north of England, and we did have milk chocolate, but we always had dark. My mum always bought me dark chocolate, and I don't know why, but I seem to have more exposure to dark chocolate, no matter what the quality was, when I was younger, when other kids were having milk chocolate. So I think subliminally in my mind, I already had a little taste for that, of something more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all parents should give their children just a little bit of dark chocolate occasionally, because it has got lower sugar and fat levels, but also just for that little taste of something more intense and intoxicating, and a little bit more sophisticated as well. And you don't have to spend a lot of money doing that, just introducing something quite young.
You walk readers through basic recipes.
Yes.
Your first chapter here is the unadulterated chocolate. You do a little bit more experimentation with, I imagine half the population of Yorkshire would be appalled that you put chocolate in your trifle. Not to mention your
Christmas
pudding.
Trifle's out the window now, that's the problem.
But there's a reason why you're called the Heston Blumenthal of the chocolate world.
There is. I like to push boundaries, but I don't like to push boundaries for the sake of it. Don't like to mess around with ingredients too much that they don't represent what they started with. what I started with. So I wanted to inspire people and take things they're familiar with, like the humble trifle, which has such a long history here, and just adapt it.
And Christmas pudding? My goodness.
Oh, it's so good. So many people in the UK hate Christmas pudding. They really do. And I love it. So I wanted to give them something where they had everything that they love about chocolate, but transposed into something that they think they don't like or do love about Christmas. And it's one of those Christmas puddings that is so much more of a dessert and less intense and hefty after that big Christmas lunch.
Oh, yes.
And it's actually been taken really, really well. And so many people emailed me after Christmas last year and said, thank you, we made the Christmas pudding. And it was, I thought I didn't like Christmas pudding, but I do.
Is it too late to, we could send the recipe to Peter's sister, Pat, she, makes the Christmas pudding.
She may have her Christmas puddings already made, I think.
Probably.
Oh, you can still make it, you can make it a short notice. Have two, have a chocolate one and a normal one.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, she makes one, which is actually a vegetarian recipe, and she used to make them in September.
Oh, you should make them a year before.
Oh,
she says usually in September, so they must be made by now.
Now,
what could possibly be wrong with chocolate pasta?
Chocolate almond tortellini with blood oranges and
there's
pine
a story behind this recipe.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, tell us, because
it was the first thing I ever made on live TV here in London about nearly 10 years ago. It was a show called Great Food Live, and it was a one-hour live show where UK and international chefs came on. It was to inspire people, and I was taken on to cook inspiring dessert recipes. At that point, I was a pâtissier rather than a chocolatier. So I don't know why I chose one of the most complicated things to make on TV live possible, and it's that full recipe, and it hasn't changed, and it's the most lovely recipe.
What is alkalized cocoa powder?
It's cocoa powder, which you can get normal cocoa powder, which is just ground cocoa beans, squeezed. The cocoa butter has been squeezed out and ground, and it's just normal cocoa powder. I think in the UK here we just call it cocoa powder, and I think in the US quite often it's called the alkalized cocoa powder. So you can use any cocoa powder, to be quite honest.
That sounds wonderful.
Now, did you win?
Well, it wasn't a competition.
No, it wasn't a competition.
No, it was a live show. It was a daily live show, five days a week, all about food and chefs, and we cooked live on TV. And that was the first recipe I made, and that first recipe obviously was a clincher, because if it didn't work, would I be asked back? Probably not. And I was on the show for 5 years.
I should think you'd probably still be on it, except you probably, no, you didn't, couldn't possibly have run out of new ideas.
No, and unfortunately the show finished.
Okay.
So that was why. But that was the beginning. I wanted to just show people that, and everybody with the book, that you can take things, again, that you're familiar with, things that you know, things that people have in their cupboards and maybe haven't used in a certain way with chocolate.
Look at this one, saffron and Greek thyme honey ganache. That's incredible.
It's gorgeous. It's really fragrant. Something really good for summer. Not too heavy. Like I say, really fragrant and very sophisticated, but one of those things where when you have it, you just never go back to making another ganache for me. It's just one of those beautiful things that you can use. A ganache is the filling for the chocolate, the soft part in the middle. So you could use that over a cake. You could warm it and pour it over desserts. You could make truffles out of it. It's one of those things that I love sweetness from honey. And saffron is one of my favorite spices in the world.
Yeah, I do too. I like it too.
Yeah, we're running out.
Could you tell me about chocolate?
We're running out of saffron. We're going to have to get some more.
Could you tell me what you do with a chocolate dressing on fish? That I'm not so sure about.
Well, there's some recipes in the book for sauces over fish, red meat, vegetables, and white meat.
Salads and ice cream.
So I wanted something where, because I love fish and I love chocolate, and I thought, how am I going to get them together? They don't work if I'm trying to make a truffle or a bar of chocolate. Not very nice. But then what I started to look at was how sweet fish was when you taste it. It's a lovely, delicate, white-fleshed fish or a scallop or a prawn. And trying to look at ingredients that work. So we know dill work. And I remember my French training at college back in 1989, one of the things we used to use a lot was Pernod with fish. And
it was
a light aniseed flavour.
Right.
So then I started to put a little bit of white chocolate in as a little bit of sweetness to make the sauce really rich and smooth. And that recipe developed from, you know, all of that experience in 1989 and bringing it up to date. And it's one of my friends, a lot of my friends make that because it's so unusual yet so lovely. And of course, you can make it the day before, but it works on all white fish.
Wow.
I don't know. I like to include chocolate in savoury dishes, but I don't want to make, rich, dark chocolate sauces just over the...
You mean like moles and things?
Yeah, yeah, I like that, but, and I like moles because it's full of spices, but over here, when we see chocolate recipes with savoury ingredients, it tends to be venison with chocolate sauce.
Oh, right,
chicken.
Yeah.
Chicken with chocolate sauce.
Yeah, chocolate raspberry. That's a Gordon Ramsay recipe, the venison with the chocolate raspberry sauce.
Yeah, it's very popular in autumn here, but I wanted to use chocolate more as an ingredient rather than just an accompaniment, if that makes sense. I wanted to incorporate it into the ingredients I was using, into the main ingredients, like the fish, the meat, the vegetables.
Here's
so
one.
It becomes one dish.
Honey-cured bacon, Stilton, and chocolate sandwich.
This honestly has become an iconic recipe. It's one of the things I've seen included in so many magazines over here in the UK because people just say, why, how, what on earth? But for Sunday brunch, it's honestly one of the most beautiful things to have. It's that balance of sweet, salty, creamy, chocolatey. It's beautiful. It works so well together. And it doesn't have to be Stilton. It could be any blue cheese.
Now, I've got two things I want to talk to you about. One, you got me worried here. And
ooh,
that's with your chocolate martini.
Oh, okay.
Because I worry about cocktails that you have to eat with a knife and fork or a spoon.
Right.
But you have enough reputation, and I've seen the rest of the book, so I have to believe probably that we'll have to try again.
Have you made it?
But I do. No, we haven't made it yet.
All right.
I'm questioning it. I'm searching for why I would want to go do that.
To make a chocolate martini.
Yes.
Because I've had so many bad chocolate martinis that don't use chocolate, so I wanted to make a martini that did actually use chocolate and not a chocolate-flavoured syrup or a chocolate liqueur that had never been near a cocoa bean. I wanted to make something that was a really, like a dessert cocktail, drinkable, not sickly sweet, really has that intensity of chocolate and cocoa, but I still had that lovely kick. It's not a purist martini by any means, but it's a purist chocolate martini.
Right. So you have to like the concept of a chocolate martini first, probably.
I think you do. You have to like those two things together. But it just worked because martinis has got such a beautiful, crisp, clean taste, and dark chocolate can have that same crisp, clean, but intense and intoxicating taste. So I thought, pop the two together, and it worked really well. It is an intense drink. One or two is maximum.
Yeah, I bet it is. It probably slides down easy. But I have to wonder, and then I'm going to ask Anne to finish up the interview because I know she's itching to ask you another question.
Oh.
But I'm wondering if you got a lot of hate mail when people discovered that you mixed chocolate and Marmite.
No, thankfully. I tell you something, this happened because this was 5.5 years ago when I opened my first shop. A very dear friend of mine, Lydia Slater, who at the time was the editor of the Sunday Times Style magazine. She loved our chocolates, came into the shop, and I was using lots at the time when I was called the Heston Blumenthal of chocolate. She said, I bet you haven't tried Marmite. And I'd already been playing around with it, and she gave me that kind of challenge. And I said, right, leave it with me. As soon as I have a recipe that works, I'll call you. So I spent 2 months developing the recipe for Marmite truffle. And it has been on collection since that day in my first shop, then the second shop, and now the third. We can't take it off the collection. People travel from all over the world for it. Something that has become iconic with what we do. And it's about, that again, that balance of sweet and savoury, but people do love it or hate it. And we can't take it off. It's just become one of, honestly, I think it's like a pop star who writes a hit single, and you have to sing it and sing it and sing it and sing it and keep singing it for 20, 30, 40 years, and you think, what have I created?
Exactly.
But you can't change it, and I can't. That's something I can never change. But do you know what it does? And it's probably the reason we're on the phone right now. And I did bring it to New York last year. I was at the chocolate show last year in New York where we did a pre-launch for the book where I let people know who I was, and we had a tasting. And same here in the UK. It was received so well. It got people talking about chocolate, which is what I want. I want people to come into my shops or see me at an event and say, why? Explain to us and talk to us about why. No matter how crazy people think I am for doing it, I think chocolate has to have some fun in it. And chocolate, and if there's no fun in chocolate, then we're doomed. We have to have some personality and some laughter and some kind of why on earth would you do that? I love it or I hate it.
Well, you've got plenty of all those qualities, Paul, and I can't wait to get to London next time and hang out with you. Which shop do I go to?
Oh, Soho. Well, you've got to send me an email and come to Soho. I'll show you around. You can have a day together making chocolates in the kitchen with myself and my team.
Oh, wonderful.
You can both see how things are done, and then we'll go out for a chocolate martini at my favourite bar, which is only across the road. Some great guys make lovely chocolate martinis, and I'm sure I'll convert you into Marmite truffles, maybe.
Oh, I would start with one of those. After all, we'd probably be arriving close to breakfast time.
It is a good breakfast chocolate, especially if you have a port and Stilton with it, because you've got a bit of cheese there as well.
Oh, Paul,
you're delightful.
I'm so looking forward to meeting you in person and continuing this conversation. It's been wonderful. Yorkshire has some great exports.
You know something? I cannot tell you how many people I work with in London and how many people have businesses in the food industry that are from Yorkshire. It's quite astonishing. I think there's so much creativity around seasonal ingredients. Places like Yorkshire, where there's a richness of seasonal and local ingredients, but you need the volume of people and press and people like yourselves to kind of get in touch and let people, you know, explore that and make it grow.
Yes,
we're on the rise with good food, so let's keep it going.
Yes, so people have to leave to go to the big city in order to be able to make their mark.
Quite often, it's true, unfortunately, but there's quite a few still go back. As long as I can, you know, post my chocolates and reach out to people in other ways, then and back home, then that's good for me.
Paul, what a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, Paul, thanks so much. Just love the book. Of all the books we get, this is one that I just heartily recommend that all of our listeners look for, Adventures with Chocolate by Paul A. Young. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Paul, for a great start to the program, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we're back now, and our next guest is a name that's a household word in all of New York, and I think probably much broader than that. You'll recognize Zabar, I'm sure, a fabulous delicatessen.
But here's a young lady who married into the Zabar family but has a fine career in the sweet business.
Yeah.
All of our own.
And I love the title of her book, One Sweet Cookie.
Well, I just said, upon meeting and talking for the first time to Tracy Zabar, that until I opened her book, One Sweet Cookie, I didn't realize how pretty cookies are. And she said, well, they're not very pretty. I have this wonderful photographer. But I think that the photographs are wonderful, but the cookies have to be wonderful, too. Now, Tracy, some of them are yours, but others you actually have from chef friends, right?
Yes. The book is 70 best chefs in New York and their favorite cookie recipes. And I was so lucky because I approached everybody and everybody was so kind. Every single person I approached, except for maybe three, shared one or two recipes. And the book is extraordinary because of that, because they're the greatest chefs in New York, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went into this controversial issue of whoopie pies.
Yes.
And gobs. And you know the big controversy over all that, don't you?
I do indeed.
Well, we just interviewed somebody, the guy, he wrote a book called Gobba Gobba Hey.
Yes.
And he's from Pittsburgh.
I'm from Massachusetts, and I think that people from New England are as passionate about owning whoopie pies as they are about the Red Sox.
I think so,
and too. I think there are people in Pennsylvania, and Amish people who claim that they came first. And I think there are people who are whoopie pie purists, and they think whoopie pies should be original chocolate whoopie pies. And then there are other people who think they should be coconut and pumpkin and all other kinds. So there's two in the book. One is a traditional whoopie pie from Maine, and the other is a red velvet whoopie pie. And they're both pretty wonderful.
I like your Romeo's Sighs and Juliet's Kisses.
Yes. Yeah, just great.
Still reminds me of that horrible place that's supposed to be the house where Juliet's family lived, and all around the walls and around the entrance archway are pieces of chewing gum with little messages stuck in them.
Right, right.
I thought they cleaned that up.
Well, they were still there, and I'll bet they're back.
I'm sure they're back.
Now, you've been there, right?
Yes.
Now, a lot of your cookies in this book have long lineages.
Well, what I did was I approached each chef, and I had a conversation, and I asked one question: what is your favorite cookie? And so some, I didn't have any control over the answer, and some of the cookies were the signature cookie or the signature dessert of this particular restaurant. But most of them, it really surprised me, and it took me aback. Most of them are either personal favorites that this chef or that chef mixed with his or her children, or things that people made with, you know, my mother, my grandmother, and I was very touched. That was those were the choices. And then there were a number of chefs who asked me, would you like a second recipe, and would you like to choose? And that was very exciting for me, because I got to put in the things that I felt were missing from the book.
But each chef only got one.
If a chef gave me two, they were put in the book. I did not reject not one recipe.
Oh, okay. So if you got two from a chef, there are two in the book.
Absolutely. And I tested every recipe twice. I had other people testing them. It was a whole year of just cookies everywhere. It was pretty great.
I did a cookbook with a chef, and so I reacted immediately when you started talking about having to translate from a chef's talk into the recipes that a home cook could use.
Absolutely. I think that was very important. Since my days as a culinary student, way back at French Culinary Institute, I was very trained in metric and weighing everything and things being much more precise, and I think that's probably a better way to bake, especially much more important for baking than cooking. But the American home baker needs to have things translated into cups and teaspoons and tablespoons. And I was very happy to do that. And I didn't have any recipes that didn't work. I just had a few recipes that I needed to go back to the chef and work out. Sometimes people gave me a recipe for 1,000 cookies, and some of them were very easily translated into small batches and some were not. But everybody cooperated, and in the end, I think all the recipes really were.
Yeah, no, we have a recipe from my Aunt Clara for cuchidada.
Oh, you'll have to send it to me, a little fig cookie, right?
Well, it's one of those cookies that has never been, we were never able to cut the quantity of it. It never worked.
Nick Malgeri has a pretty wonderful one.
Yes, he does.
You could definitely use.
Well, you talked to John Besh, because didn't he have a recipe for cuchidada?
Yeah, he does, too.
In one of his cookbooks, too?
I mean, do you know that the Sicilian settlement in New Orleans was extraordinarily high. Did you know that?
We actually found out why. It turned out that the local population didn't like the idea of slavery much, and even after slavery was over, they didn't like to work too hard. So the enterprising New Orleans said, well, we better get people who can do work from somewhere. So they found a lot of Sicilians who were willing to work the plantations, and they came over in large numbers. But they were the only people dumb enough to actually do the work that had previously been done by slaves.
Well, that's interesting.
Amazing what you find out when you ask a question.
But John Besh, his book, My New Orleans, he has a whole section on Italian, with Italian specialties, Sicilian specialties.
Well, that's how we found out the connection.
Well, I actually had great recipes, because thanks to Nick Malgeri for cucidati, but I did not have a recipe for fig squares. And when Karen Damasco gave me a recipe for some raspberry granola bars, and then she said, would you like a second recipe, anything you want? And I said, my whole life I've been trying to reproduce the fig squares from the bakeries in the north end of Boston, and I've been there. I've been to maybe three of them, and I've talked my way into the kitchen, and I asked, how do you make the fig filling? And they, all three of the big bakeries, which will remain nameless, they pulled out big white tubs of commercial fig filling, and that was not it for me.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
And I just wanted the fig squares of my childhood. And in my book, Karen Damasco made a fig filling. And I was so surprised because it has pepper in it. It has white wine in it, things that I would not necessarily have vected in a fig square. And you can't really taste them, but it's exact the fig square that I remember. I waited my whole life for this.
Oh, that's great. I'm looking at it right now. They look wonderful.
Isn't that amazing? Now, growing up, I remember, I mean, I don't eat cookies now, hardly ever, but in England, you ate them all the time, and the Fig Newtons were a particular favorite of mine, and I don't really quite know why, but I think I had one like a few years ago, and it didn't taste the same. I'm like, somehow or other, they shortcut the recipe.
Well, I grew up in Waltham, Massachusetts, which is next to Newton, and so I certainly probably have eaten 10,000 of them.
Oh, so called
so that's what
Newton.
I call
Fig Newtons. I believe so. I believe that they're local, but you know, a lot of commercial cookies have preservatives in them now, and so they're not what we remember. And I think I think it's one of the reasons people are crazy about baking and making handmade fresh things, because there's nothing like them.
And this looks good too, corn cookies.
Those were amazing. And that's Chef Alex Gruner, and he works with Chef Dan Barber from Blue Hill at Stone Barn. And he introduced me to a number of heirloom flours that elevated my baking, because I used a lot of flours like red fife flour, the corn flour, and graham flour that I had never used before, and that was an amazing experience. And his cookies are so buttery and they're so delicious.
Now you're talking about O-U-R flour, not O-W-E-R flour.
Yeah, exactly.
You threw him for a minute there. I thought, well, exactly. I suppose you could use roses and
I don't think
carnations and things like that. But
I think people do use rose water in certain cookies, but I don't think there are any in this book.
No, that's not what you meant. Okay.
Right.
Got it.
Now, you have something about, the big thing, everybody's looking for something to replace cupcakes is the hot new dish. And do you think you found it with some of these cookies? Like, what was it I was looking at that was supposed to be hot?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think cookies are the new cupcake. And in the book, there were a few things that weren't exactly cookies. Like, they're maybe close to cake and close to donuts. And I felt they were delicious, and who was I to argue and quibble with the chef? And so they're in the book. There's a recipe for lamingtons. Did you see
that? Yeah, we used to live in Australia. We never had lamingtons.
They're so good. And I wrote in the book that when I was going to have them photographed, the chef asked me, it's Sean Hergott, and he's adorable and wonderful and Australian, and he asked me how many I needed for the photo shoot, and I needed 2. So I asked him for 2,000, and he laughed, and he sent me 24 of them. He sent me this giant tray of them. So I think my children had them every single night for maybe 3 weeks. They were so good.
And you've got Chenchi here. Yeah. Sir Macioni, the Cirque's recipe. That's not bad either.
Mr. Macioni gave me the recipe as his favorite cookie, but it actually is Mrs. Macioni's recipe. So that was really lovely that I got to include both of them in the book.
Yeah, now, do you have, one reason you should come to Pittsburgh is to go to a wedding here.
Oh, yes, yes.
The cookie table.
And I would bring a suitcase.
You know about the cookie table.
If anyone's listening and having an Italian wedding, please invite me. I would absolutely come.
It's rather extraordinary. I didn't realize it was so unusual until everybody started writing about it, the cookie table. You just did it.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I actually have been to some weddings and bar mitzvahs that were community affairs that all the people in the community baked and cooked. And I think it's just a wonderful, amazing, extraordinary experience. And I think that there has been a resurgence of popularity in things like the cookie exchanges, cookie swaps. And I think it's the same concept, and it certainly is, you know, it's a lot of work spread out over a lot of people, and it makes it a delightful social occasion. So, again, please feel free to invite me. I'd love to come.
Well, Tracy, it comes through here. I said to Peter when we were just getting ready to interview you, she has a really good sense of humor, so this ought to be a fun interview.
Oh,
it comes through so nicely in your introduction, as your idea of wanting to share all these wonderful treats with people and getting everybody baking. It's a wonderful, it's inspiring book as well.
Oh, but thank you.
The interesting thing is that there is a recommended way that you will use this book and not grow fat, and that's if you just look at the pictures.
Yeah. Well, the way that I did it, my husband works at Zabar's, and he spends much of his time tasting things, and it's never an issue for him, but he's a runner. But the way that we did it was I baked every single day. I baked 3 or 4 batches of cookies a day.
Wow.
Part of it was here in New York, and part of it was at my house at the Beast. And I basically put 3 or 4 cookies in the cookie jar, and the rest I just bagged up. And I have an adorable little dog that I walk 4 or 5 times a day, and I would take the cookies with me. I would give them to the doormen in New York, the homeless people. And I was always headed for the shelter, but I never... Well, a few times I made it, but most of the time I would just give it to people in the street. And I'm sure people thought I was crazy, but then everyone came to expect it. And now I see people and they say, what, no more cookies?
Aww.
So that's the way. If you share the cookies and you pass them out. And my sons and one of my son's girlfriends, we'd give them every night that they came for dinner, I'd give them bags and they would bring them to school and to work. And it was a very good thing.
Well, the generosity shines through in this book. Well, listeners, again, it's called One Sweet Cookie by Tracy Zabar, and you encounter a lot of your favorites. I did. I found things that I hadn't had in years, and then a lot of new things as well. So keep up the good work, Tracy.
Thank you, Anne, and Peter, you guys are so sweet. Thank you very much.
So tell us what your next book will be when you have it out, and we'll talk to you again.
I shall. It's already in the works. It's almost finished. It's about little pies.
Oh, that's you. That's supposed to be the next hot thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll wait and see. Everybody's rushing out cupcakes. So, all right, Tracy. Bye for now.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Ciao.
Okay, ciao.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Okay, sweetheart, so what's up next?
We have now Michelle, who has a singular knack with something we all love, pies, both sweet and savory.
Simple Simon met a pie man going to the fair. Michelle doesn't know. Well, I somehow or other, the pie man separated Simple Simon from his penny, and he didn't get any pie. Now, that certainly isn't true at Michelle's Pies. Michelle's Pies, the existence of which is itself a story. So why don't you give us the elevator pitch version of that, Michelle, just to bring everybody up to the present day.
Okay. Well, I grew up baking with my grandmother, and it was one of our favorite pastimes that we always did together. And I had always told her, even as a little kid, that one day I wanted to own a pie shop. And she'd always tell me, there's a lot of work, your hand's going to hurt, and this and that. And so when I kept telling my family that I wanted to open a pie shop, they were like, no, you know, you have to go to school, go venture into something, and if that's really what you want to do, you'll end up at that point at some point in your life. So I went to Fairfield University, and then I went and did nuclear medicine down at Mount Sinai Hospital for a couple years. And then when my mother had passed away, I had to move back up to Connecticut to take care of my grandmother. And I did real estate for 5 years, which I absolutely disliked. It wasn't my favorite thing.
Right.
And when my grandmother passed in February of 2006, the last thing I said to her was that, Grandma, one day I'm going to make your pies famous. And it was like not only a month later, I was watching the Food Network, and it was a show about America's Top 10 Pie Companies and how they all got started at farmers markets. And I knew farmers market season was right around the corner, so I frantically got on the phone and figured out how I could start this business in Connecticut. Quickly find out that in Connecticut you have to bake from a commercial kitchen, and
right.
You know, they're impossible to find. And the economy was really, really good back then, so no one was giving up their kitchen space. So I got really frustrated and thought maybe this wasn't going to be a reality, and soon realized that my family has a little ski condo up at Killington, Vermont. So I figured maybe I'll try Vermont and just see if their rules are a little less stringent. To come to find out that in Vermont you can bake from your own home kitchen and get a license right away out of your home kitchen. So I went up to Vermont that week, got a license, and started farmers markets that summer, doing about 3 or 4 markets a week in southern Vermont, where I went from baking just a couple pies at each farmers market to nearly an average of like 200 pies between 5-inch and 9-inch pies at each market.
But then you started to really get on the map
because
you started to enter contests.
Yeah. So then that April, I entered into the National Pie Championship for the first time in 2007 and won, not even thinking I ever had a chance. I won with our chocolate pecan bourbon pie. And my husband now looked at me and said, you know, he wasn't my husband then, but he looked at me at that point and was like, you burned through 3 ovens this past summer in Vermont. You are baking 24/7. There's no way you can do this. Now you have a national ribbon. You need to open a bakery. So we decided in that December of 2007, we opened our first Michelle's Pies in Norwalk, Connecticut.
So you moved back now. Now you knew you were going commercial, right?
Right. I mean, I was still living in Connecticut at the time when I was up in Vermont. I was going back and forth between my real estate career and the baking career. I mean, I was literally working 24/7. I don't know how I did it.
Well, you continued to win awards, and you even confronted Bobby Flay, right?
Yep. Now we have a total of 26 first-place ribbons from the National Pie Championship. We've been on Good Morning America for the Best Slice of Pie in the Nation contest. We had a throwdown with Bobby Flay. We've been on the Today Show. So we've gotten quite a bit of exposure, and last week my first cookbook came out, Perfect Pie.
Yeah, and that's what I have in front of me, and I just don't know that we actually mentioned your whole full name, which is Michelle Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T.
No, we're keeping that a secret.
Okay.
A lot of people know Michelle's Pies under Michelle Albano. I did just get married this summer.
Okay.
So that's why the book is published under my new married name, Stewart.
Oh, okay. So you married Mr. Stewart, Kelly Stewart.
Yes, exactly.
Now, what's the secret? Do you give all the secrets away in the book?
I give quite a few pie-making tips, but the true secret to making a perfect pie is, and our motto at Michelle's Pies is that all pies are made by hand with love. You need to feel the love. You need to not get frustrated and intimidated by the pie-making process, and that's what a lot of people are lacking when they first venture off making a pie.
Well, you have a lot of showpiece pies in here, traditional ones,
mm-hmm.
And you do, of course, the most intimidating part of a pie is the crust, and you give people a little room because you do some crumb crusts and so forth, too.
Yeah, but I really try to bring it out in the book that you can mix and match. It's only fresh fruit at Michelle's Pies, so I really stress in the book that you can use, you know, if you're making a blueberry pie, you can make it with a double top crust, you can make it with a crumb. If you want to try a walnut crust, if you're too intimidated by the pastry crust, there's other options.
But you also give tips, which impressed Peter, on making regular pie crust.
Yeah, how to make the perfect crust. Don't work it too much and make sure it's cold. See,
yeah,
that's what my mother
always told me, but it's not that easy.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, the 2 pages in the little italic numbers.
Yeah.
They're worth the price of the book right there for someone who didn't know like I do that's what you're supposed to do.
Exactly.
This is something that's right on trend, too, Michelle, is you have the section on party pies, which
mm-hmm.
uses all these things like marshmallows and M&Ms and candy corn.
Yep. Well, like our classic party pies are Candyland pie, which in the book is featured as our trick-or-treat pie, which is a whole bunch of different kinds of candy. It's an Oreo cookie crust with Snickers and fudgy brownies on the bottom, and chocolate cream swirled with Reese's peanut butter cups and marshmallows and decorated
Snickers.
M&Ms and candy corn. So it's a great way. You can mix and match that pie, too. Add your, you know, leftover Halloween candy.
I'll bet you can.
Make your own creation.
But I wouldn't.
but this is a really complete pie book. Because it's got a real recipe for an Australian meat pie.
Uh-huh.
Because apparently, how long were you out there? You visited Australia.
I was out there for a month, and it was about 8 years ago.
Okay.
And while traveling the country, I was absolutely in love with the beef pies. And so when I came home, I decided I had to make my own version of the beef pies, since it's hard to find around here. And so this is my version. It's definitely Americanized, since there were a couple ingredients that I'm sure are harder to get over in America versus Australia. But I've had a lot of Australians that came to the pie store and said this is the closest thing that they've had since they've been back home in Australia.
Oh, right.
I thought it was very interesting that one of the ingredients you use is actually a pre-made gravy mix.
Yes.
I mean, why make it difficult on yourself, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, and that's what it makes it easy to make.
Right.
Not many ingredients.
Well, I think you draw people in also by including things like quiche, which...
Mm-hmm. We have a whole savory pie section.
Yeah, that's in the section with the meat pie.
Yeah, I know.
You have the chicken pot pies and...
Chicken pot pies are really hot right now, aren't they?
Yep, they are. You know, especially with the winter coming up, it's a comfort meal.
And then you do pizza, which is another whole category
of
pie.
Well, no, that's a pizza rustica. That's an Italian meat pie for Easter.
Oh, I see.
It's not really pizza. It's about pie. This is a pie lady.
Pizzas are pies.
This is Simple Simon's friend. They're not really. They're just called.
Well, they're called pies.
Yeah, I know, but they're really not. They're really not pies. They're pizza.
Here's an Italian wheat pie. Yeah,
it's really flatbread. It's not. It's not a pie at all.
Tell me this. Everybody keeps saying that pies are going to be the new cupcake. Do you think that's true?
Yes, definitely, and it has been, you know, documented in some papers and media that pies are the new dessert of 2011, that cupcakes are out, pies are in.
Well, I haven't seen that happening. I still see all, they just opened yet another Magnolia Bakery in, I think, in California or someplace, or Chicago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yep, but, like, even, you know, we do little mini pies, and we do a lot of pies for weddings, you know, where they're, like, cupcake size, but they're little mini pies, and we tear them up. Same type of thing that they've been doing with the cupcakes, but they're pies.
Now, you aren't worried about the fact that since you gave all your secrets away, business at Michelle's Pies is going to go down?
Not at all, because...
Because there are people like me out there.
There's still a lot of people out there that, even though they've got the book, they're not going to bake.
Oh, and even if they bake, they're going to come.
They're going to still come because it's easier to buy it.
So now, do you do internet orders?
We don't at the moment. If it was really something somebody wanted, you know, they could
call up the store.
But, yeah, we don't have, like, a full internet section where we ship out pies.
Yeah, no, I told you I ordered Monica's on.
Yeah, but that'd be another thing to do altogether, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now we've opened up a second store in Westport, Connecticut, so need to ease into that and the cookbook and make sure everything's in order before we jump to that project.
And things are going well with the stores? I mean, you sell out every day?
Yeah, we do, pretty much. And it's hard to predict some days, but Thanksgiving coming up, we sell thousands and thousands of pies for the holidays.
Pumpkin.
Yeah, pumpkin's huge. We use all fresh pumpkin. We process about 68,000 pounds of pumpkin a year, and there's a section in the book on how to process pumpkin correctly, which is a great tool. If anybody, too, is looking for pie tips, I also do the pie hotline. I've worked with Crisco in doing the pie hotline, which people can always call in for pie tips if they get stuck in the middle of their pie-making process.
And is it a phone number or a website?
It is. It's 1-877-4-PIE-TIPS. And if there's tons of tips on there, including myself, bring some pie tips. And then there's also a hotline where there's a live pie expert speaking 24 hours a day.
So now it's called You're Living Happily Ever After, right?
Yes.
Well, that's a good smiley story, Michelle. Really.
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. It's been
and your book is a delight. So once again, it's called Michelle Stewart, Perfect Pies, the best sweet and savory recipes from America's pie baking champion.
And don't forget, if you're in southern Connecticut or not too far away in Vermont, you can make a trip to the stores. One's in Norwalk, and where's the other one?
In Westport, Connecticut.
In Westport, Connecticut. So, and there's a website for all of it. Undoubtedly.
Yep, it's www.michellespies.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, and say hi to Kelly.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Michelle.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
So, Rapido, let's take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest, Amy Traverso, would certainly subscribe to the saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and an apple a day will do more than that.
Yes, and she's a little bit obsessed with this, and it's a great reference book as well as a cookbook.
And it's a beautiful book, too.
Yep.
With apples all over the cover. What a surprise. So here's Amy.
Amy Traverso, this is, without a doubt, the best apple cookbook I've ever seen. In fact, it's the only apple cookbook I've ever seen.
it's leading in a one-horse race.
the Apple Lover's Cookbook. And I have to say, the recipes are absolutely scrumptious in it. Oh, and the pictures. Why would I open it to the blue ribbon deep dish apple pie? It's making my mouth water. And you had also apple ice wine with it. Oh, boy. Anyhow, you go through how many different breeds of apples?
About 60. I think actually there are 59 apple varieties in the book.
And aren't they pretty?
I went into in detail.
And there are how many in the world altogether?
Oh, in the world, the best estimates I've seen are that there are about 7,500 varieties of apples under active cultivation.
Goodness.
There are definitely more than that because there are many categorized apples that just grow and we don't know quite what, we haven't named them. And then in this country, probably about 2,500.
Wow.
Oh, wow, that many. We were talking before we came on the air about the apple breeding program at the University of Minnesota, and I guess they're inventing new ones, but they're inventing them rather slowly. Apparently it takes a very long time.
Well, that's because they graft. They can't just
So they have a graft develop, and then they have to taste it to find out if it's any good.
Yes. I visited a breeder in Geneva, New York, who works for Cornell. Her name is Susan Brown, and she took me out to her test orchards, and it's just incredible how much land you need. You do a cross, and you take the seeds and plant them and wait years before you know if you have anything good.
Right.
It's quite an operation and very expensive.
Yeah,
now for those,
and they destroy most of them, don't they?
For those apple lovers out there who remember listening to our interview about Sweet Tango, the new apple developed at the University of Minnesota, Amy is telling us it's now on the market. We're not going to name the store you can buy it at. We'll just hope that perhaps it'll come to a Whole Foods near you.
It will be
all right for you to go buy it. So they are in circulation. They were delicious because we tasted them several years ago, and the memory still remains.
Amy's favorite one I've never even heard of. What's it called? Something in winter?
Oh, the Calville Blanc. Yeah, it's a French apple, the full name is the Calville Blanc d'hiver, the Calville Blanc of winter. It is a French apple from about 1690. And it is the traditional apple that you use to make a tart tatin. And it's just a really lovely, very, very firm, dense apple with a real tartness when it first comes off the tree, but that mellows after it sits in storage for a little while. And it develops a nice sweetness and almost an effervescent flavor.
Wow.
Some people have said it tastes to them a little bit like champagne.
Champagne.
And you can cook that apple for hours, and it won't lose its shape. It won't get mushy.
Now, you start off your book with take 59 great apple variations, and you do an in-depth description of each one, but you divide them into four categories. Is it four? Firm tart, firm sweet, tender tart, and tender sweet. Then you go in to your recipes, and, well, you do tips and techniques, of course, for everything about apples, and then you go into your recipes, and you always have a reference back to your descriptions of these apples.
Yes, I wanted to make it easier for people to know which apple to use in a recipe, because even at your typical supermarket, you have access to several varieties, and it's hard to know, should I use these Gallas in the pie I want to make, or should I use Granny Smith? So organizing the apples into categories was intended to help people know, okay, this is a firm tart apple, and firm tart apples are really good in pies and rich buttery desserts where that extra acidity kind of balances out the dish. And firm sweet apples, I think, are really great. They're good in pies, particularly when you mix them with a firm tart apple, and also in cakes and other baked goods where you want something a little sweeter.
So why on earth would you eat a Red Delicious?
Oh, yeah, I hate those.
I wouldn't. I would not eat Red Delicious.
You wouldn't.
There are so many
plastic
apples out there.
I think they're plastic.
Too bad, because the original Delicious apple was, in fact, delicious. It had very rich flavor, and there are some growers, actually, who are still growing the older type, but over time, the large-scale breeders were favoring the fruit that was uniformly red and had a thick skin that meant you could chip it and it wouldn't dry out.
I hate that thick skin. That's the thing I hate the most about it.
No, the thing about it, I hate the most is it's sort of mealy tasting.
Yes, they eat them off the tree and they're okay, and they're certainly much crisper and have a little bit more acidity, but they just get mealy and saccharine so quickly.
Now, how did you get this thing about apples?
I think they made an impression on me at a young age. I grew up in Connecticut, and we would always go apple picking every year, and like many people, but I think I just fell in love with the beauty of apple orchards and really just look forward to that every year, loved the kind of foods that my mother and grandmothers would make with the apples. And then as I grew up and started cooking and learning about food more seriously and started looking into the incredible variety of apples and the number of varieties that there are, then it just sort of became a little bit of an obsession. Married in an apple orchard, and that kind of sealed the deal.
Okay, now I'm picturing you pitching this book to a cold-hearted publisher. However did you manage to do that?
You know, I got very lucky because a dear friend of mine is an agent, is a book agent, and she agreed that there was a place. I was telling her about my wedding, and she said, I think there's a place in the market for an Apple cookbook. Do you think you'd want to write the proposal? So I didn't even have to jump through that first hoop. And then once we wrote the proposal, we found a very enthusiastic editor, Maria Guarnaschelli at Norton, who just really understood and believed in this project from the beginning. And I feel so lucky that she fell in love with the book as much as I did.
When you mentioned your wedding, you got married in an apple orchard.
Yes, we did. It was an apple-themed wedding. It was kind of ridiculous. Colors were, you know, greens and pinks and reds, and the favors were caramel apples, and the tables had apples on them, and there was apple cider. It was really something.
Yeah, and you finished off with Calvados, I guess, right?
Yes, we had a cocktail that we served that was cider with some spices and Applejack.
Now, here's a bit of interesting news for you, and if you can't make the connection, we'll help. There's a distiller in Portland, Oregon, who's making Calvados from apples grown on Mount Hood. We visited just a few months ago. We were supposed to meet him, but he was delayed.
His place caught on fire.
Yeah, there was a forest fire on Mount Hood, so he wanted to watch his property burn to the ground. So we never did meet him, but we did taste
his
Calvados.
Absolutely fabulous.
And it was a fabulous product. His name's McNally, Steve McNally. So if you can't find him and you want a fix of good old USA Calvados.
Oh, that's great.
We'll make the connection.
We tasted
for you.
He has all these blue ribbons and stuff. And a friend of mine who's from the Pacific Northwest said, because we were going to Portland, that when he was in Paris, he saw this line of Calvados on the shelves right next to the famous French labels.
Wonderful to see.
Oh, so apples are wonderful things. But back to the book, because the book is it's a love story about apples, but it's also a cookbook.
Yeah, she gives us also now, she gives us the history of the apples. I learned that there really was a Johnny Appleseed, though he didn't sound like anybody I'd like to meet.
Well, there was an apple in the Garden of Eden. What variety was that, Amy?
Well, you know,
it was a pomegranate.
We don't know for sure, but the most likely culprit would have been a pomegranate. The apple wouldn't have grown in that climate as the story is told.
You're right, of course.
It was a later interpretation. I think Van der Goes. Painting The Fall of Man was depicted an apple tree in the Garden of Eden, and that was where we began to associate apples.
You also, in addition to the history, you walk us through some wonderful personalities in the apple trade.
I really enjoyed this part. I traveled around the country and visited apple growers in New Mexico and Washington and California and up to New Hampshire, and it was really inspiring to spend time with people who are growing apples and researching them and making wonderful things with them, like great hard cider. And I wanted to just give readers a feeling for the full world of this fruit and not just what you do with it in the kitchen.
Well, you have some wonderful recipes. The traditional savory pairing, of course, is apples and various things with pork. But then you have one recipe and you say you were experimenting with, could apples possibly go with beef?
Yeah, I didn't believe they could.
My
editor suggested apples and beef, and I thought, I don't think so, but I'll try it. And I braised some beef brisket in cider, hard cider, with some green apples, which aren't sweet, and I thought they might stand up to the beef a little bit better, and it really was lovely. I love this dish, and I've had good feedback from readers on the brisket.
Charles, duck and goose and all those.
Yeah, but Anne's favorite recipe in the whole book is apple pan dowdy. So you get to tell the story of apple pan dowdy.
Well, the term pan dowdy comes from the idea that you are, well, let me back up. With a pan dowdy, what you do is you cover kind of a skillet apple pie with crust, with a typical pie crust. You layer it over the apples, you let them cook, and about halfway through cooking, you push some of the crust down into the juices, and you're to use the old term, you're dowdying the crust. You're making it a little homely. But what happens is the flour from the crust thickens the juices, and then also the juices coat the pastry and give them this beautiful glaze. It's such a sweet, traditional, old-fashioned dessert, and there are so many apple desserts that they just make you feel about as cozy as as can be. And this one is definitely an old New England recipe, as far as I know. It was a favorite of President John Adams. It really dates back early 19th century.
I like the way you explained the fact that the pastry crust wasn't nearly as good as it is today back in those days, because they only really had flour and mortar. They didn't have, Crisco hadn't been invented yet.
That's
didn't
true, that's true. Originally, yes, you would doubty the pastry to make it edible. And now you just doubty it to sort of gild the lily a little bit.
That's what she says in the story of the dish, I noticed that.
Didn't they have lard?
Apparently they must not at this point have gotten around to the idea of using lard to make pastry.
Yeah, you often see recipes that were made with what were called pastes, which was just flour and water, and that would be your pie crust. I'm sure in wealthier settings you did use butter or lard for your crust. But for everyday simple cooking, it was just flour and water, so dunking it in the juices really improved a lot.
I'm sure it did, and we're not going to have Anne sing a book about Pandowdy, which rhymes with howdy. We did a screen test of that before we came on the air, and I decided even if she wanted to try, I'm the editor, and I would have removed it.
Well, you know, this book makes me feel guilty, because I realized you said, think of things from your childhood having to do with apples, and everybody has one. I remember baked apples, just baked apples.
Yes.
And nobody bakes apples anymore. I mean, I never baked a single apple for our son.
I remember those. I mean, you core them, and then you put
cinnamon and sugar
and raisins and stuff like that in the middle, and then you just bake them, and they're really delicious.
Yeah,
they really are. It's a health cozy dessert. I have a couple of recipes for baked apples. One is pretty traditional with dried fruit in the center and cider, baked in sort of cider, but there's another one that has an almond paste filling with dried cherries, almonds.
Oh, wow.
And sort of it's almost like a frangipane kind of filling. And apples and almonds are such a nice pairing. So that's worth trying. And I want to say, if you're baking apples, my recommendation is to use Pink Lady apples or Jazz apples, which are two of the newer varieties coming from Australia and New Zealand. The reason I recommend them is not only do they keep their shape when you bake them, but they also keep their color. So they really look beautiful when they come out.
Yeah, I remember the color wasn't so good from the
baking. Yes, most of them turn brown, but these don't.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, first of all, for your contribution to apple lovers everywhere. Because if you're an apple lover, you need to have this book so you can get more apples into your diet.
And you've got to make sausage and red onion sandwich.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good, too.
That's a really nice sandwich.
Oh, you're just wonderful, Amy. It was so good talking to you.
Well, thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
The only thing I'm worried about is what you're going to do for an encore.
I'm trying to, I'm still so obsessed with apples. I would like to do another in-depth book about a single subject. I'm having a hard time letting go of apples, so I haven't been able to get passionate about anything else yet.
Well, don't go near plum cots. We did that one. That was really boring. Thanks, Amy. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So there we are for this week's program. Be sure to tune in again next week. We have more sweet delights for you then. And until then,
bye-bye.